The content of this episode discusses violent crimes. These topics are sensitive in nature and may be difficult for some people.
Welcome to Shove Under Podcast, the Toronto Public Library podcast for readers, writers, and amateur sleuths. That's right, today we're talking about true crime. I'm Michael Warner, and today I'll be talking with my colleague Jason Bazadian about the popularity of true crime. Then I'll talk with journalist Justin Ling about his experience covering true crime in Toronto and his take on the genre. And as always, we'll give you some of our own book recommendations.
So welcome to the show. I'm Jason, and I'm here with Mike, and we're going to be talking about true crime today. So Mike, why did you want to talk about true crime, or what interested you about that?
Well, I'm a pretty big fan of the genre, I would say, in sort of like podcasts, movies and TV shows, books. It sort of encompasses a large amount of my media consumption. Not as much as some other people who are like the true hardcore true crime people who like consume everything, but it's a large part of what I consume. True crime is actually what got me into podcasting. So wow. Serial was the first podcast that I listened to. As I imagine, for many people that was the first. So I'm a fan of the genre, but it's something I have a complicated relationship the more I think and read about thoughts on the genre, but it's not something I think we talk about a lot in the library. I've always noticed that it's one of the genres people come in and ask for most often, not like a specific title, but I've got a lot of people coming up to me at the desk often and saying, oh, where's your true crime section?
As somebody, I've been listening to podcasts for maybe 12, 13 years now. So for me, I had been listening to them actively, right? And then suddenly, basically out of nowhere from my perspective, suddenly everyone was talking about podcasts and it was all about Serial and true crime. And so it really kind of waysided me. Like, I was really surprised that suddenly there was this huge interest. And it's just been this thing that's kind of grown and grown and grown on its own. Isn't that right?
Yeah. And, I think if you were to go look at a lot of the podcast charts, you'd find a lot of true crime shows near the top of what people are listening to. But I think it's the kind of thing that's like, it's always been there. We've always had, newspaper coverage on true crime and books written about true crime. And then, a wave of TV shows that started covering true crime and documentaries. And, now it's a huge Netflix genre as well of like, what's the next Netflix true crime show going to be? But yeah, it definitely has become huge in podcasting as well. Jason, I was wondering if you read or listen or watch true crime.
I'm familiar with the genre, but it's not something I know a ton about. So it's kind of been on my periphery for quite a bit of time, I'll say. I do read quite a bit, but I guess I'm more... when it comes to true crime, looking at like the more literary versions of that. So things like Truman Capote and In Cold Blood, that's the kind of stuff I'm more familiar with.
I find it's a very different experience to read true crime than listen to it. There's that sort of like intimacy. I mean, there's an intimacy to podcasts, but I find it even more so when it's just like you and the written page and you can take your time with things and reread and go, sort of through more at your own pace. And, a lot of true crime podcasts, some of them go heavy overboard with the music and sound effects and, a lot of the things people might think of when they think of a true crime TV show and the sort of, it plays at the dramatic elements. But with the book, you really get all that stripped away. It's a much different experience often to be reading the book, but so much of it also depends on the writer and if they were a reporter for the story and how they approach the story.
Right. And just depending on the style of it is so much to people's particular tastes. Like I love comedy, right? But when I try and read it, I can never get much out of it, and it never really gets much out of me, for instance. So I try not to read much of it, honestly, because I just find it very clinical. It's like I can feel the joke structure or something like that. So I know it's completely off topic, but it's just in the same approach. That's probably a little bit how I feel. It just doesn't match with my own sensibility that way sometimes. But there are examples for sure of things that I do like quite like, but... So it hasn't really struck in the same way. I'm still finding my voice or my way to it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the same thing with any genre, but looking at, you know, true crime, sometimes you get ones that are just focused strictly on a particular case,
right,
or a particular serial killer. And other times you've got books or podcasts that, you know, sort of open up and look at the world through a crime and sort of expand it out into the legal system. That's become another big part of true crime lately, is, mm-hmm, you know, looking at cases with wrongful convictions and finding out, you know, how the legal system impacts those cases and the structures that have been put in place to, you know, wrongfully incarcerate people. So I think for a lot of people, if you're listening to this and you maybe have some misgivings or maybe just haven't found the true crime that works for you, hopefully in the interview we'll give you, and our suggestions later on, we'll give you some other options for different true crime styles that might meet what someone's looking for.
Right. Well, you're hitting the nail on the head there, because that kind of context is something I really do enjoy. And like, what does this case mean in a larger societal context? What culturally does this say about us? For me personally, it's when it gets very salacious and very violent. That's something I'm not very much into. And I think my own bias about that is thinking it will be that is what's keeping me out of it quite often sometimes.
You never know until you start reading something or start, right, listening to something what it's going to be like. I'm thinking of a good comparison are sometimes mysteries,
mm-hmm,
where some people want the cozy mysteries and some people are good with the like Scandinavian stuff that's going to be really bleak and depressing and has some really, you know, gory deaths and things like that. You can't know like ahead of time, is this going to be something that opens up and looks at society at large, or is it going to be a sort of slasher version of all the gory details?
Right, exactly. That's a very good point. So it's something to explore for me for sure, but it's something I'm still kind of tiptoeing towards, I guess. Leading us into who you interviewed, you interviewed Justin Ling about true crime, right?
Yeah, I did. So Justin Ling is a reporter and journalist. He covers a wide variety of topics, usually sort of politics and policy, but ended up, as he discusses in the interview, covering what became the Bruce MacArthur case, and did a season of CBC's Uncover, which is a podcast series that CBC has with different seasons, and they all cover sort of different true crime related cases. So he did a series of that.
And if you listen to any kind of Canadian podcast involving journalism or politics, you probably are familiar with Justin Ling already. He is a really great reporter and host of a couple of different podcasts as well. I know him from Canada Land, Oppo. That was a great show that he did as well.
And that's actually the reason I listened to this podcast series,
yeah,
was because it was Justin Ling. When I first saw that they were doing a Bruce MacArthur podcast, I was like, I don't need to know all those details. I don't want to know, you know, it wasn't a case that I followed while it was happening much in, mm-hmm, real time. But I knew that someone like Justin Ling, if he's reporting on a case, that would be covered in a much more meaningful way than just a serial killer podcast.
So I'm really excited to introduce this because I think it's great. So we'll just take it away from there.
I'm joined now by Justin Ling. He's the host of the third season of CBC's Uncover, which is called The Village. Hi, Justin. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming.
You bet.
I was wondering if you could start by giving a brief synopsis of The Village.
Yeah, so you know, for our season of the podcast, we decided to start with sort of delve into the case of men who started disappearing from Toronto's gay village starting in 2010. Of course, that story opens up and speaks to the charges against Bruce MacArthur. He was, when we started the podcast, he was accused of 8 counts of first degree murder for 8 men who disappeared between 2010 and 2017. And so we sort of trace that story back from the, you know, the very early investigation into his eventual arrest and the discovery of more victims and more bodies. But we decided to do something a bit different with it. We didn't want to do something sort of straightforward. So what we ended up doing is looking at more than two dozen cold case murders that took place in Toronto, stemming all the way back to 1975. And these are cases that Toronto police believed Bruce MacArthur may have been responsible for, and that we decided to sort of go back and look at anew, because they really did not get, we don't think, a full investigation at the time, didn't necessarily get a full treatment in the media at the time, and even when they were announced they were being reopened, still only sort of got a cursory glance. So the point of the podcast was sort of to go back and speak to a lot of those cases and speak to the sort of the societal circumstances at the time that may have led to those cases going unsolved for so long.
And your background in journalism is a lot of covering politics and policy, and you end up doing this true crime podcast. So I was wondering if you're a fan of true crime as a genre.
No, I've actually, I think I was for a long time. And ultimately what ruined true crime for me was just covering true crime. I covered one case in particular a number of years ago in Montreal. It was the murder of a young gay Chinese exchange student. His murder was gruesome. It was recorded on video and it was uploaded online. And, covering that case from the first discovery of the victim to the discovery of the video, to the manhunt for the perpetrator, Luca Magnotta, to the court process. It was just horrible. It was a horrible process. And then to watch how the true crime genre sort of took hold of that case, eventually there was documentaries made of it, and I thought it was all just kind of really grotesque. And I think it really just turned me off of the entire genre. So it was never really my plan to get into covering this case as true crime. I originally started working on it just because no one else was, and I kind of realized that if I didn't do it, it was unlikely anyone else was going to. And I've tried to, at every step of the way, sort of reject the sort of traditional true crime lens whenever I've tried to work on this, whether it was the podcast, the book I'm working on, any of the stories I worked on. It was always supposed to be one that put the police process and the victims first, and then, without trying to sensationalize or romanticize the case or the perpetrator.
So, what are some of the tropes or elements of the traditional true crime genre that you take issue with?
I think it's almost the sort of the romanticization, as I just said. A lot of the times these cases can be told in such a sort of an outlandish fashion, or can be sort of painted with such a brush where you're often, if it's some, whether it's a book or TV show or podcast, sometimes you're kind of given the story through the vantage point of the killer's eyes, which I just always find a really horrifying plot device. It ends up trying to, maybe inadvertently, it ends up creating a sort of empathetic relationship between the viewer, the listener, the reader, and the person who committed the crimes, all while sort of dehumanizing the victims. And a lot of the times, the coverage of these cases really just removes the entire police element to it. It looks at these cases in very black and white terms, as though this is just something that happens and that there's, sort of nothing to be done about it. And that it's always just good police work that wraps them up, when in fact there's often systemic, structural, and personal issues that lead to these cases not being solved. And by glossing over them, we're sort of we're skirting accountability for the police institutions and the media and the public and so on that are supposed to prevent these cases. And I always find that it's a handful of serial killer cases or true crime cases that seem to garner just the vast majority of attention, and a lot of cases where maybe the victims aren't quite as photogenic, or where the case is not as salacious, just get completely glossed over. So that's always bugged me. All of those things taken together, and a thousand other tropes.
So as you talked about, The Village talks a lot about systemic issues with the police force and their policing of the gay community, and for that reason, this has been identified as a sort of ethical true crime podcast. So I was wondering, what to you defines ethical true crime?
Yeah, I think it's one that sort of doesn't do what a lot of those tropes I mentioned earlier. It's one that puts the victims first, that only really does the story if it grapples with societal issues that need confronting. I think Connie Walker's Missing and Murdered podcast, which deals with the murder and the disappearances of Indigenous women, is particularly good for that. It you know, it really addresses the societal reasons why Indigenous women are overrepresented as victims of crime, instead of sort of glorifying or sensationalizing the men who killed them, oftentimes the men who killed them. And I think, you know, that is a good archetype. You know, there is In the Dark by APM Reports that looks at, you know, a justice system that is so, you know, fundamentally unfair to black men. You know, I think that's another great example. There's several like this. You know, sometimes they're associated with the CBC, but there's a whole bunch of other, usually public broadcasters who deal with these cases, you know, with an ethical lens. And they don't always have to be, you know, they don't always have to have the level of, you know, I think societal importance that the maybe Missing and Murdered does. But at the very least, they need to grapple with cases in a way that respects the victims, respects the families that are still around and their friends, and sort of deals with this in a sensible and sensitive way. And I think it's hard to do it that way, but I think if you don't do it that way, it is an unethical podcast by definition.
And as you've talked about, one of the big criticisms of the genre is using people's trauma and pain as entertainment. Can true crime be both ethical and entertainment?
I think so. I've had people tell me that they found my podcast, you know, difficult and sad and tragic, but also entertaining at times. I mean, there's parts of our podcast that is, you know, has energetic music and that it's funny and that it's humanizing. It doesn't have to be completely dour. I mean, you know, these people were still humans. They shouldn't be defined entirely by the way they died. You know, they had normal lives. They had happy moments. They had sad moments. You know, so on. And I don't think there's anything wrong with highlighting that. The problem I have is where you turn their actual homicide into the entertainment, which a lot of these podcasts do. The books, to a different degree, movies certainly have. But, you know, this genre of podcasting, there are many out there that literally want to sit and laugh at the way these people died. I'm sure there's all sorts of psychological reasons why people find that, you know, relaxing, entertaining. But you know, even if it's good for you and your listeners, that has blowback on real people who are still alive. You know, I've talked to people who have had their apartment buildings broken into by true crime fans, who have been harassed by phone, text, email, you name it, by people who want to know more information about how their friend died. You know, I've heard cases of, you know, people's of victims being kind of post-mortem accused of being complicit in the murders. You know, this stuff is absurd. And you're really forcing people to relive trauma and to experience new forms of trauma by going and doing that. And I think it's reprehensible. And I think for these folks who are hosting these podcasts to not recognize their complicity in that is pretty willfully blind.
So as you're doing your reporting for initially the story and then the podcast, how do you approach the friends and family of the victims so that your reporting and speaking to them doesn't have a negative impact on them?
Yeah, I mean, we try whenever we can to do it very gently, very politely, to give them an out, you know, to say, you know, if you don't want to do this, if you know you're really uncomfortable with this, that's fine. If there's a way we can do this that will make you feel comfortable. If you want to have friends over, if you want to do it over the phone, do you want to do it over email, do you want to do it in person, do you want to do it in a neutral location, all that's fine. If there's things you don't want to talk about, that's okay. If, you know, there's things you don't want us to mention, that's great too. So, you know, these people don't need to be held accountable, right? You know, a lot of the times you go into interviews, and it's not acceptable to allow, say, a politician or a minister to block off parts of the interview of, you know, for things you can't talk about. But for somebody who's recently lost a loved one in a traumatic way, there's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with having them say, I'm not touching this part. You know, I don't want to talk. You know, we had a family member of one victim say, you know, I don't want to talk about the night I found his body. And we said, that's fine. You know, that's not necessary for us to know. Let's talk about what you're comfortable talking about.
And I'm wondering, too, if after you've spoken with friends and family, were there moments afterwards that you debated using that for the podcast?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We definitely had some parts of conversations that touched on things that weren't relevant to the public. And it wasn't a hard call. We just said, listen, there's no real benefit to the narrative we're telling. The thing you just told us has no, you know, bearing on the investigation or, you know, why they were killed or why it went unsolved. We're just going to cut it. You know, it might be interesting. It might be a tense moment or an impactful moment, but it's not worth using. It's not worth the the traumas it could cause for the family. You know, they mentioned this, but I don't think they thought through what it would be like to have this broadcast on air. And we didn't use it. And it wasn't a difficult call. I don't, you know, we had some debates on some pieces of information, but ultimately we just generally sided with the idea that, you know, if it wasn't really materially important, we weren't going to use it.
So, like I said before, a lot of your other work in reporting deals with privacy. So how do you try to respect people's privacy, even like the fact that someone may not want reporters reaching out to them? I know you've mentioned before in other interviews that a lot of people in these cases get hounded on Facebook yeah. and social media.
We just don't contact them a lot of times. I mean, you know, there was some people who in this podcast I knew had faced a lot of interview requests and were very reticent to speak to media. I made some very gentle approaches, sometimes through friends of theirs who I didn't have to do it directly, and, you know, didn't try to goad them into doing it, didn't try to badger them into doing it, just said, listen, this is the option on the table. We want someone on the record speaking about your friend. We'd love it if it were you. If not, we understand. And in some cases, they came on. In some cases, they didn't. And we kind of let that, we left that up to them. People have the right to privacy. People have the right to not be hounded every day, especially by journalists. I don't know why some journalists think they have an automatic right to have people pick up the phone when they call, but they don't. And, you know, we try to make all of these approaches very sensitive, very gentle. And I think in the end, there was people who, you know, straight up told us, like, we're talking to you because you didn't harass us, right? So, it's not as though this is just you give up and never try to get anybody on the record. You know, sometimes being respectful and human and actually talking to people like they're human beings, you get more flies with honey, I suppose.
Thinking of true crime and maybe a need to have it be more ethical, where does that responsibility lie? Is it with consumers, producers, both?
I think it's mostly with the producers. I mean, I would like to say that the public should just, you know, not tune into these things, but, you know, whatever the public, you know, if you put a mass media out there that is entertaining, the public's going to listen to it. It kind of makes sense. It's not their job to consume ethically, right? It's our job to produce ethically. And if you don't recognize that you have a duty of care to people, especially the people you're talking to or you're dealing with, then you're in the wrong industry. You know, I think a lot of these people who host these podcasts like to think of themselves as entertainers instead of journalists, but you're producing a podcast about real life events. You know, it's not a comedy show. You're like, what you're producing is in the realm of journalism, even if you might not accept it, even if it doesn't sound like it, but it's having kind of that impact. And people who are listening to you look at you as, in some ways, a journalist. So you do have a duty of care. And I think to not recognize that is irresponsible.
I just wanted to read a quote from an interview you gave about the podcast, where you said, "What I'd failed to anticipate is just how personal a story like this can be, just how much you get invested and linked to these people's lives." How has covering the story impacted you?
You know, I think a lot of people I've spoken to who have worked on this story had to have, you know, exercise a significant level of self-care, or, you know, had to be very careful and with the story. I've covered enough horrible things that I think I've developed my own coping mechanisms and have been good at keeping my mental health, you know, safe. So I don't even like to dwell on what impact it had on me. The impact it had on people who were in the center of the story is really what's, I think, most pertinent here. You know, friends and family, some experienced suicidal ideation, some went into depression, some, you know, had to pull their phones out of the wall, some left, you know, lost or left their jobs, some, you know, couldn't leave the house. It's the range of impact on these friends and family was staggering. Some of the journalists I know did really have, you know, a tough time with this, but ultimately those who kind of experienced this the most were those who were kind of left behind, and who really weren't looked after by a lot of the journalists on this story, and I think were sort of mistreated in a lot of ways.
Knowing that friends and family have such a tough time in these situations, not just with the fact that a loved one has been murdered, but dealing with all the other pressures around it, do you feel an obligation to the friends and family when you're reporting on a story?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, I would check in with some of them, you know, not for a story, not for a quote or anything, just to say, you know, how are you doing? You okay? Like, everything fine? How can I help? And, you know, and that is where you get into journalism ethics lines. You know, like I said before, I'm not here to hold these people accountable. They have no accountability to give to anybody. But, you know, the line of whether or not you're friends is a difficult and complex one. In some cases, I do kind of consider some of these people, you know, my friends. And it can be a dicey prospect to then sort of go to your somebody who you sort of become friendly with over the course of the story and ask them if they, you know, can give you information for a story or speak to you on the record. But, you know, I'm more comfortable navigating that sort of ethical waters as opposed to, you know, going to these people and sort of asking them for information and asking them horrible questions and then just leaving them alone to sort of suffer in silence. I think that's much worse.
So it's been almost a year since the podcast came out. And I know you've talked, I was listening to a panel you were on and you were talking about how sort of people expected this to be a straight up serial killer true crime podcast and then sort of got tricked into it almost. Has your perception of the true crime genre changed as you've heard stories like that and talked with people after the podcast has come out?
I think my perception of the market has changed a lot. You know, I was staggered by how much people wanted something like this, right? And not just mine. Like I said, Missing and Murdered has a huge constituency. The other seasons of Uncover, which all generally deal with these cases very sensibly and sensitively, have had a huge audience as well. There is a huge demand for well-done true crime that is both sensitive and impactful and thoughtful, which is, again, why I find it so frustrating that other outlets are out there doing the kind of bottom of the barrel stuff, because there is such a demand for this the prestige ethical stuff. So, you know, I did hear from a lot of people who didn't appreciate the podcast. You know, beyond just sort of the true crime element, we get into a lot into police entrapment of the community, into police oppression, into the struggle for, you know, sort of equality and queer liberation. And people didn't appreciate that. And I think, you know, the fact that they didn't is exactly kind of why we did it. You know, so many of these people didn't know any of these things, and some people chose not to learn. But many others kind of came out and said, listen, I didn't know any of this stuff. You know, I had a vague knowledge of what the bathhouse raids meant. You know, I even talked to queer people. I should say I learned a lot producing this podcast. There's stuff we put in there that I had no concept of before we reported it. And I heard that from a lot of queer people as well, including people who had been around for 30, 40 years, saying, yeah, I was in Toronto in the early 1980s and I was at some of the demonstrations and even I didn't know some of this stuff. And that was really impactful. I really appreciated that. And I think it actually kind of it really underlined the degree to which we didn't always do a good job of documenting collective history. And so to that end, the fact that we could sort of take the true crime genre and sort of mold it into something that was sort of a vehicle for many other things, I think it was a success. I think people appreciated it. And I think it sort of showed that true crime can go to, you know, ethical true crime can go places that maybe people didn't totally anticipate. And I think hopefully between this or maybe one of the other podcasts that sort of attempts to do this as well, it kind of draws a map for people to go do this instead of sort of the lazy thing.
So the podcast was one season. You've got a book called Missing from the Village. It's coming out later this year.
Yep, September.
September, excellent. How is that going to differ from the podcast?
The book was always intended to be more of a kind of a honed in story about just the men who went missing and the investigation and the arrest of Bruce MacArthur. You know, from doing the podcast, I think I learned so much that I'm having difficulty not putting. I am in the end putting some stuff, you know, from the Toronto's past in the book, and I'm trying to kind of broaden it a little bit to highlight that yes, we've paid a lot of attention to these eight cases. But what about all the other cases that haven't been solved? There's a number of murders of transgender women in Toronto that we've barely talked about in years that have sat on a cold case desk with no movement. And I think it's a shame that we're able to talk so fulsomely and commission so many projects about, you know, the Bruce MacArthur case and do so little about those. But so the book is sort of trying to be a lot of different things, kind of an account of exactly, you know, what my experience was, an account of the investigation based on police and court documents, an experience of the friends and family, stories of these men's lives, but also the broader problem about police relationships with the queer community and investigations into missing persons cases and violence against queer people. So it's a lot of stuff.
I know you've given a couple of podcast recommendations throughout, Missing and Murdered and In the Dark. Do you have any other recommendations, books, movies, other podcasts for true crime related that you can recommend?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple good book recommendations. You know, there's one book called Killers of the Flower Moon. It's by an incredibly good New York Times reporter. And, you know, it's just a fantastic look at, you know, it's cold cases, but much older than ours. It's a look at murders of Indigenous peoples in America, kind of the early 20th century, and how that sort of was directly informed by government policies at the time. And it's certainly many much older cases, but it feels very contemporary. There's a whole bunch of original reporting in there. It's really, really, really well done. And on the flip side of that, there's this incredible book that's sort of been informing how I'm writing mine, called Ghetto Side. That's a look at just kind of the nuances and the specifics of murders in, you know, America's inner city, especially targeting black and brown men. And it's just a look at how over-policing when it comes to, arresting and targeting and surveilling marginalized communities doesn't always actually lead to good outcomes when it comes to homicide investigations, and how that sort of tension completely fails a lot of marginalized communities. And it just resonated so strongly for me, you know, spending all of these months and years looking at how police were arresting gay men in bathhouses and parks and washrooms, but then not solving their murders when they went missing or got violently killed. It was just so stark and so similar to how police were so hell-bent on arresting black and brown men in the inner cities for, say, cocaine possession, but seemed so incapable of solving their murders when they were shot to death, just was so striking to me. And the book is a really, really good look at how that system can be fixed.
Great. Those sound excellent.
Yeah.
And of course, people will be looking for your book out in September.
Yes, please.
And
do.
Until then, where can they follow your other reporting work?
You can follow me on Twitter at Justin_Ling. I have a website, justinling.ca. I try to occasionally update it with bylines that I have coming out. I write a lot, so it's actually very hard.
Follow you on Twitter.
Sure. Yeah, it's probably
way.
The easiest.
All right. Thanks so much for your time, Justin.
Absolutely. Thanks.
So, Jason, as someone who hadn't listened to the podcast series that Justin did, or and you know, you don't have a lot of experience with true crime, what were your initial reactions from hearing that interview?
I really found myself agreeing with his take on the true crime genre and kind of wanting to provide more of an ethical guide or like framework towards this kind of genre. Because these are so of the moment stories, there's real people being affected. And I can see how easily and seductive it is to kind of forget that fact. But it was really interesting to hear somebody kind of want to do better and really actively working to be more compassionate with the people he's talking to and still tell a story, but not focus on just hammering away at the gory details, as I think he said. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting that he comes at it from the point of view of a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it seems like a tough line to balance how to make an ethical true crime. And I don't want to seem like journalism is the answer, because it's not like every journalist is covering this as compassionately as he did.
I agree totally. This is something I struggle with news reporting in general. I try and avoid what I call headline journalism, which is just when the facts of what you as a person need to know are in the headline. So when you're talking about a gory detail or crime or something, or somebody, you know, a horrible car crash or something, everything I need to know as a person is in that headline. I can read the rest of the story about where it happened, how badly the person was hurt and stuff like that. But I don't need those details personally, and I don't want them either, frankly. That can be what the journalists are after. Not that they mean to be, but they're trying to get all the details they can get. And that's not necessarily where we want to come from for this, I think.
And I've listened to some excellent true crime podcasts that, especially ones that look more at wrongful convictions, aren't necessarily people who are journalists doing that work. Going back to Serial, one of Adnan Syed's relatives started a podcast called Undisclosed with two other lawyers, and they started off initially, the first season was just looking at the Serial case and sort of going into an even deeper dive than Serial and looking at all the legal issues that happened with the case. And they've strung that now into, it's been going on for years now since Serial ended, just looking at now other wrongful convictions and really looking at those cases and trying to prove innocence for a bunch of people that they believe are in prison who shouldn't be.
For sure. And it's just, I think it's up to everybody to act in a responsible and ethical manner, regardless of what your training or background is. And if you're trying to do that, nobody's going to get it right 100% of the time. But the important thing is that everybody's trying to act in a way that is responsible, social and, you know, responsibility, that kind of thing.
So I have a concern with the term ethical journalism, which is that I'm fearful that it's going to get overused because, like, it's going to become the thing that everyone wants to be.
Yeah.
So it's going to be like in the 2000s, like early 2000s when everything was artisanal.
Yes.
And that just became like a nothing word for food.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden it's going to be like, everyone's just going to be like, oh, this is my ethical true crime podcast or my ethical true crime book. And it's going to get like so overused that it's going to mean nothing eventually. Like everyone's going to think their true crime thing is ethical.
Right. And this is the flip side of particularly podcasts, right? Where it is more of a Wild West. There's nothing to stop anybody from just releasing and following none of those things just because they have a good audience. I'm like, well, why would I change any of this?
So we've talked a lot about podcasts, but I think we should give some recommendations and especially some book recommendations as well.
Sure.
We can ping pong this back and forth. So I'll start us off.
Okay.
So the first book that I want to recommend is called I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara. People may already be familiar with this book. It was pretty big when it came out. She was trying to find the Golden State Killer on her own. Well, not necessarily on her own, but using, there's sort of like a community of people on the internet who were all trying to find the Golden State Killer.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was one of the people who was trying to do that using the internet and research and like genealogy websites and like DNA databases to find serial killers or like family links to that. And she died before the Golden State Killer was found and before she completed the book. So the book was completed after her death. I think it was released just around the same time that the Golden State Killer was actually captured. So it was an interesting read for both sort of her process. She talks about the reasons why she became interested in true crime, which dates back to an incident that happened in her childhood. And there's also like, I think a 3-episode mini podcast series about how the book was put together after her death. So if people want a podcast series to go along with the book, that's one that I recommend.
Wow, that sounds awesome. The first one I want to recommend is called Tokyo Vice. It's an American reporter on the police beat in Japan. It's written by Jake Adelstein. He being a writer and a beat writer, essentially, for crime in Japan, he just kind of delved into this world and came face to face with many Yakuza bosses and Yakuza members and kind of delved into that world on a completely different level in like a way that, especially as Westerners, we really don't know much about them and finding out more and more about them. And it's just his experiences writing about them and that really feeling that fear, too, of fighting this organized crime. I know it's a little bit different from a true crime, but that's one of my forays into that.
I mean, I think that fits. We didn't discuss this earlier, but to me, true crime is really anything that's just about real crime. It doesn't. Yeah. A lot of people think murders and serial killers and you know, that might be some of the most popular ones from the genre, but I definitely love a lot of the ones that are just like weird, unbelievable crimes sometimes, like long form magazine pieces about art thieves and things like that are to me also part of like this fascinating genre of true crime. So that sounds really cool to me. I would love to read that. So my next recommendation is a very new one and that's still sort of in the Toronto news, and it's called The Billionaire Murders by Kevin Donovan. He's a reporter for the Toronto Star and has done a lot of reporting work on the Barry and Honey Sherman murders.
Oh, yeah.
That happened, I believe it was December 2017. So that was one that I picked up, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect from that one. And I was actually very surprised that the book is almost more a biography of Barry and Honey Sherman.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a lot of information and details about the crime, this is not a book for you. But if you're looking for what I would say is an ethical true crime book, because it very much is, it's about the victims and their lives, and it definitely, you know, paints a really vivid, strong picture of what they were like as people. So I found that actually really fascinating, and it was not what I expected. He spends very little time on the murders, so that's one that I would recommend. And just an interesting sort of tidbit that I learned from the book, which relates back to the interview, is that when Barry and Honey Sherman were killed, a lot of the police who were working on the case at the time were not from the homicide division.
Oh.
Because so many of the homicide detectives were busy gathering information and getting ready to arrest Bruce MacArthur.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was an interesting little tidbit about, because there's been a lot of criticism in that case about how the police handled the case. And part of the reason is because all of their resources were so focused on Bruce MacArthur. But no one knew that at the time because this was before the arrest.
And it's still an open case, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes. Like
they're still looking for what happened. They're not sure.
Yes. So he does posit a general theory, a very vague general theory at the end of the book about what happened to them. But it sort of places an interesting context of, you know, how police work can be affected by another case that no one knows about at the time.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Thanks for that, Mike. And my last one is called Underground. It is by Haruki Murakami. The subtitle is The Tokyo Gas Attack and the Japanese Psyche. So this is a book, if you're not familiar with it, in 1995, there was a sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subway, and it caused a lot of deaths and obviously a lot of chaos. And basically, Haruki Murakami, who is this very famous Japanese fiction writer, just decided he wanted to learn more about it, and he wanted to get a bunch of firsthand accounts from people who were there, family members of people who died, police, just different levels of government and people involved, just to see what they had to say about it. And it's really interesting, again, this is my Japanophile stuff showing through again, because it is the story of how and what and why this happened, but also how that is unique to the way Japan would handle this situation. And basically, that's his kind of point. How do the Japanese handle something like this? Because it is this kind of society where, in a lot of ways, things are kind of kept back, right? So when something is forced to the forefront like that, how do they cope and how do they deal with that? And it's just this really interesting dive into the culture through this lens of this crime, essentially, this huge terrorist attack.
So I have one last one.
Okay,
and,
great.
And this fits in my category of, I would say, weird true crime or things you might not necessarily think of as true crime. And it's called The Billionaire's Vinegar by Benjamin Wallace. And it's partially about the counterfeit wine world.
Oh.
So, yeah, not something you think of as maybe existing or knowing about, but there is a world out there of counterfeit wine, especially for old vintages of wine that, you know, people might not have any context for what a 200-year-old bottle of wine looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But the things people do to create, you know, realistic forgeries or reuse wine bottles in order to sell wines at auction and, you know, get a lot of money from something that may or may not be fake. And a lot of the time people don't know until they take that bottle home and maybe open it to find out whether or not it's actually the, you know, what they bought is inside the bottle.
I've also heard that, like, with old wines, it is kind of a thing where they're not sure, even if you do get an official one, like, that it will be drinkable even still, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah. So that's my offbeat niche true crime subgenre.
Really great recommendations. I am really interested to check those books out, and it kind of gives me a window into what true crime is. I guess I'm showing that my biases were there in place, right? I have certain ways of expectations of what I kind of define as true crime, but you're opening my eyes so that I can say I can explore this in a new way and kind of be okay with it, I guess.
My mission is achieved.
Your mission is achieved, exactly. I think that brings us to the end for this episode. What do you think?
Sadly, I think so. I will have a final pitch, because in the first season, I covered romance as a malign genre, and this season, I'm doing true crime. So if anyone out there who's listening has something, a genre that, you know, is maybe misconstrued or is maybe overlooked, doesn't get the dues that it might be deserved, send us an email to shoveunder@tpl.ca for something we might use in a future season or future episode.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. That would be great.
Michael Warner and Jason Pizzadian work for the library. Justin Ling is a freelance journalist based in Toronto. He was the host of CBC's Uncover the Village and author of an upcoming book about the investigation of serial killer Bruce MacArthur, due out in September 2020. You can follow Justin on Twitter at Justin_Ling or visit his webpage at justinling.ca. Music by Highs. Shelve Under Podcast is a Toronto Public Library production. It is produced by Wendy Banks, Jason Pizzadian, Ted Belke, Michael Warner, and Christina Wong, with production assistance by George Panayotu.